From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. National Security Advisor John Bolton is out. President Trump confirmed that on Tuesday. What does it mean? And more importantly, what comes next? We discuss that with Professor Tony Montero, who spoke with us via Skype from Philadelphia shortly after the announcement Tuesday. So Bolton is out. I did predict it. You know, he was the ugly face Trump wanted to portray. He was red meat for the Republican base, and he's out there thumping his chest. He's appointing people president of Venezuela, and he's going to blow up Iran and God knows what else. And now he's going to be looking for a job with the French Frying Legion or something. I don't know. You remember, we saw him job hunting at the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, we saw him there, yeah. And I thought, and I can't be certain of this, he appeared to be drunk. But, you know, that's right. Another story.
Yeah, there was something going on there. I don't know.
Yeah, but, you know, for my money, he always appears to be drunk, even in the Bush administration when he was the UN ambassador.
Yeah.
But this was a unhappy marriage. They had nothing in common. In fact, I don't know if Donald Trump has anything in common with hardly anybody in the foreign and military policy establishments. Even Bob Woodward. In his book called Fear, the 17 months, the first 17 months of the Trump presidency, told the story about how Trump was taken to the Pentagon by McMaster or one of those, McMaster, I think it was, and they were giving him a briefing, and the generals were, and Trump walked out and said he disagreed completely with everything they had to say.
Yep.
And that, to me, was a very, very important sign. Of course, we know what his foreign policy platform was, non-intervention, no regime change. And what I have called, and I think it's accurate, imperial retreat. And by that, I meant retreat from the neocon policies of the last almost or maybe 30 years now.
Yeah.
I was not interested in this narrative about Trump is a fascist. Trump is the most racist president in history, and on and on and on. And all of the, and you've gotten it too, all of the vitriol about have you lost your mind? How could you say these things? And I think it's very clear. I mean, all you have to do is read the New York Times article on Bolton's firing.
Right.
And they point out that Bolton wanted regime change, not only in Venezuela, but really in Iran and North Korea, which would mean real war on a scale that probably we haven't seen since Vietnam or maybe since World War II.
Yeah.
But at any rate, he's gone. The message is clear. It is an opportunity also for those forces in the United States who claim to be for peace to come out publicly and say, here is where we support President Trump. You know, the New York Times also points out that there's a possibility this October that Trump and the president of Iran will meet on the sidelines of the General Assembly meeting of the United Nations.
Right.
So it's a good day for those of us who are in this for the long haul, the long game in the struggle for peace and for imperial retreat.
Yeah, you know, I thought it was an interesting bit of timing. And I wondered how they were going to finesse this, because this is the month that the General Assembly meets, as you mentioned. And the General Assembly has what they call the general debate or the open debate, where the head of state or whoever is sent by each of the 190 some odd members addresses the other heads of state and the world from a podium in New York at UN headquarters. There have been some really famous speeches given there. Where one comes to mind with Hugo Chavez talking about the smell of sulfur after George Bush had just left, for example. Fidel Castro, Muammar Gaddafi, on and on. And Trump did win the election while he was saying that he was going to do all of those things that you characterize, I think, accurately as imperial retreat, that no more wars of regime change, no more nation building, NATO is obsolete, wouldn't it be better to be friends with Russia and China, et cetera, et cetera. It's a multipolar world. Mm-hmm. And so, as we see actual evidence of this, as we'd mention these things to people, to some of our colleagues on the left, and they're looking at us like we suddenly became naive. I really have never been accused of that until after 2016 in my entire life, honestly. Many other things, yes, but naivety was not one of them.
Well, Don, they were looking at me as though I had become addicted to Jack Daniels. And I don't drink that
stuff. I know you don't drink. Yeah, right. I know.
Yeah. So, it's been quite a journey, to put it mildly.
Yes, it is. But on that point, though, of imperial retreat, I think it's accurate, because that was, look, the issue that he was bringing up repeatedly with respect to NATO, for example, was the cost. And also with the regime change wars, and also with the hostilities towards North Korea. Even, whoever even mentioned the fact, the U.S. has been doing war games all over the world for, since World War II ended. No one ever said, how much it costs to put on a weekend of that stuff? $82 million just for gasoline and blah, blah, blah. And he said, let's stop with the war games in Korea just to save the money. And he told us what the money was. It was like, damn. So, that in fact is the basis of a real imperial retreat, is that the empire can't afford to spend the money anymore, projecting its power in the way that it has.
And, we can never forget, when he says that NATO is obsolete, what he is saying is that the Cold War with Russia is obsolete, because NATO is really the vanguard, the spearhead of the military, the militaries of the West surrounding Russia and moving closer and closer to the borders. And you can't forget that Trump said this at the same time that, according to the Clintons, the corporate Democrats, and the neocon establishment, Russia is in violation of international law because, I put quotes around this, it's occupation of Crimea.
Right.
So there is, when you connect the pieces, and many people have, Stephen Cohen, who is an expert, a recognized expert in bourgeois circles on these matters, sees Trump's moves as creating an opportunity. Gareth Porter is another person. Right. I mean, the problem is that what is left of the left, because most of it has gone over either to the liberals, the liberal Dems, and that Cold War scenario, or have gone into hiding because of embarrassment over their abject failure to see the logic of history, especially as that was manifested in the 2016 election.
Right.
So, hey, Donna, we've been saying this for I don't know how long. I know I'm blue in the face and I'm black. I don't know how you've transformed. How many times do you have to say the same damn thing for people who claim to be woke to really understand what's going on? It's very disheartening. And so I guess the last thing, I don't want to talk too much. I have arrived at the conclusion that it's no longer of any use to have very much to do with the so-called left. We have to go directly to those people who the Clintons of the world and who the left of the world calls despicable.
Right.
And
deplorables, et cetera.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Those are the people who have decided that they don't want war anymore and they don't want austerity anymore and they want a different type of presidency and a different type of policy. And that, you know, I mean, the way things look right now, Trump wins re-election. And I think his attempt to negotiate over the heads of the foreign and military policy establishment to negotiate an end to the war in Afghanistan, it was thwarted for the time being. He couldn't carry it out. But he attempted. It confirms what we have been saying. You look at what his moves in Syria. It's amazing. Now, the economic, his economic, foreign and international economic policies are a whole different question. But even there, he creates possibilities for a different type of world order that is not global neoliberalism, that does not hurt the working people of the United States or of Vietnam or China or Russia. I think that as crazy as it might seem right now to say it, there are possibilities inherent in the logic of developments that he represents that we have not had before us since the beginning of the Cold War.
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at one of the things that, you know, there's so many, I say this almost every time you and I speak because you set me off on this whole track of logic. But there's so many nested contradictions in the political condition, you know, one inside another, inside another. Looking at 2016, for example, you know, we saw Trump attack Obama over the, and I won't call it the normalization of relations with Cuba because it wasn't that, but making a, you know, a step towards allowing more Americans to go, you know, unfettered to Cuba and spend some money. That Trump attacked him for that because he was targeting the Cuban vote, the exile vote in Florida, because he wanted to win Florida.
Absolutely.
And that's a very right-wing constituency. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he was also going after the emigre population from Haiti in Florida, which is actually a left-wing constituency. Mm-hmm. These are the people that have escaped from the right-wing U.S. governments in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And he also apparently won them. Going forward, you had some changes that were reported on for the 2018 election, for example, in Florida, that raised the question of can Trump win Florida, because without it he can't be reelected. And so you have the policy of the U.S. towards Venezuela that's been the U.S. policy since Clinton, essentially, because Hugo Chavez was elected in 1998. He took office in 1999. Clinton was in office until January of 2001. And in April of 2002, the U.S. already attempted a coup, essentially.
Right.
So the policy that shows hostility towards the Bolivarian Revolution has been policy since Clinton, and it went through Bush and two terms of Bush and Obama. So, all right, they have suddenly an expectation that, I mean, people are going to basically be campaigning for this constituency in Florida by who's going to be tougher on Cuba and Venezuela. And so how much tougher can you get than appointing Bolton to be in charge of it, letting him run hog wild, buck naked loose, okay, like he did, where he actually appointed somebody else president that even people in Venezuela never heard of, and then not have regime change at the same time or even a shot fired. And that's where we are so far. I mean, there have been some shots fired, of course, with, you know, people that are, they have criminals on the ground that are, you know, trying to raise Cain. But there has not been a U.S. military action at all. And yet, Trump still has a good shot at winning that vote.
Right. And see, my point is this, that I deeply disagree with the Trump administration's policy on Venezuela and in South America, period.
Me too.
I disagree with it.
For sure.
And I understand and understood at the very time of this Guaido thing in Venezuela that for Trump, it was a matter of Florida going forward to 2020. He was not in it, as they say, to win it. He was in it for symbolic and domestic political purposes. And of course, the counter-revolution has been defeated, and the Maduro government is now attempting to consolidate itself and overcome many of the mistakes that it made. I don't think Trump ever thought he had a chance of overturning the government of Cuba.
Agreed.
Yeah, and he really was not in that. He was not trying to, for real. Nor has he ever had the purpose of overthrowing the government of Iran. He said that.
That's right.
You know, so he is consistent in a kind of, I would say, crazy rhetorical and symbolic and performative way, you know, but still there's a consistency against regime change. That's not him. Right. Now, the administration is, of course, more than Trump. And the institutions that guide and control foreign policy are bigger than any administration. So the guy is almost single-handedly fighting a deeply entrenched war and predatory establishment.
Right.
They have become drunk over the last 75 years on war and military spending. No, so you know, I am of the opinion that we have to look at all of this in totality.
Agreed.
And I'll just stop here. But,
no, you
know, to go at this with a dogmatism, without an examination of empirical evidence, and to make ideological points rather than to create greater possibilities for enduring peace, precisely what the American people want. Even the Trump constituency, the Trump base, has given up on war, and that is extraordinary. It is a political shift. We have never seen, well, since Reagan or maybe even before, where the Republican Party, the base of the Republican Party, that's why they call it the Trump Party, because it subverts and transgresses the normal assumptions about what the base of the Republican Party is all about.
Yep.
You know, and here we are. They are the real constituency for peace and an end to intervention.
Yeah, I mean, we saw that on the floor of the convention in 2016, too. But, you know, one of the one set of almost comedic contradictions is the way that, I guess, the public discourse, but I would say, for me particularly, people who consider themselves of the left participate in the public discourse, where they attack Trump from the right over, for example, emoluments. You know, that Pence goes to...
Oh, are we back to the emoluments?
Yeah, that's been out there again. Yeah. So
right.
Pence goes to Ireland, and he decides to stay in a Trump-owned hotel there.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, this is evidence of corruption at the highest level, that this is some kind of kickback. Now, Trump, meanwhile, is, you know, putting the squeeze on Cuba, okay, and I'm not so sure that that's actually, you got to look closely at the stuff. It's not good, for sure, but it could be worse. And yet, if... you know, and supposedly he belongs entirely to Putin because the oligarchs there, you know, he wants to build a hotel in Moscow, okay? Now, mm-hmm. President Diaz-Canel is president of Cuba. The capital of Cuba is Havana. This is a basically a paradise. It's a little, you know, dusty. It needs to be, you know, cleaned off a little after 60 years of sanctions and such. But it's a beautiful city. And it has, though, like two Malia hotels. Okay, it's got the Malia Cohiba and the Malia Habana. The Hotel Nacional de Cuba, maybe three or four other big hotels. It could use a half dozen. And if you look at the prime real estate in Havana, there's room to put a Trump hotel in the center of that. And God forbid, with a license for a casino.
Oh, boy.
Okay? And if Trump were playing that game, I think he'd be more focused on Havana than building a hotel in Moscow, personally.
Okay? Or building one in North Korea.
Okay,
you know?
Right. But that's supposedly what's driving his policy in those other places.
Right. Well, see, I think the liberals have played this emoluments clause out. I mean, I don't know where they're going with that, but it's clear that Trump's idea of foreign relationships is that we can all live in peace, we can all make money if we give up war and just had economic relations where we built hotels and infrastructure and those types of things. Now, whether his vision can be realized under capitalism, especially late-stage capitalism, is a whole nother question.
Right.
But the issue is that he is against war and intervention, you know?
Yeah, well, I think the Marxists have to admit to themselves that this question arises as a consequence of, you know, the situation that capitalism is in right now, that it can't afford. This is the central contradiction. This is the kind that makes the edifice collapse in the first place. It cannot afford to support the machinery that holds it up.
That's right. That's right. And I agree with that, you know. And I think Trump is smarter than most people give him credit for. And he knows, first of all, he knows that the axial center of world history going forward from the middle of the 21st century will be Asia.
Yes.
And anybody that's not friendly with the leaders of Asia will be left out in the cold. I don't know that Hillary and her band of jolly idiots understood that at all.
On their pivot to Asia?
Yeah, with the TPP. But, you know, I think that that in the sense of the medium and long game of the progressive and radical forces, we're in a better situation than we have been in over the last 70 years.
Yeah.
The unraveling of the structures of the Cold War, and certainly the undermining of all of the institutions of American hegemony. In fact, there are informed writers who see Trump's moves as ultimately undoing the special privileged place of the dollar in international trade and finance.
Right.
I mean, the guy is not only helping the world to move towards multipolarity, but he's also helping the world to move towards trade and finance that is not just dominated by the dollar, a basket of currencies.
Right.
And I think everybody understands. I think the Iranians understand that. I think the Chinese understand. Now, of course, when Trump makes a belligerent statement, the Iranians or the Chinese or anyone else is going to respond in kind. But then after they finish making statements, as with Kim Jong-un, then they sit down and become the best of friends. Right. How do you explain that?
Right. Well, I mean, look, let's go back to Mike Mansfield, you know, looking at Nixon going to China.
Okay.
And, you know, he was the one that that coined what became only a Nixon could go to China. Nixon, you know, cut his political teeth, you know, ferreting out communists. He was, you know, one of the attack dogs in the McCarthyite period. Mm-hmm. And actually, even before McCarthy, he was out there attacking. And when China had its revolution in 1949, he was the one that was raising the question of who lost China, as if it, you know, somebody had it in their pocket and it fell out. He's looking under the furniture for it. They were blaming politicians that China, you know, that China had had a revolution. He was the person that, if anyone else, attempted to make normal relations with China. And for people that aren't aware of this, the U.S. did not recognize China's government, which was installed with a revolution in 1949, until Carter. Even the Nixon and Ford administrations, although they had had relations with China, did not recognize China's government as being the legitimate government for China. And so Nixon suddenly, given that even after him, people were afraid to advocate for China, Nixon was best poised to go to China and negotiate a deal, because there was no one to his right. And this is the function that Bolton and Pompeo and Abrams play for Trump. When he put the three of them together as a team, he lets them go out, they dance around, they scream and holler, they say crazy things, they hold press conferences. That's about it, though. There's no, you know, the actual policy that goes along with that is muted from what it would have been in the Obama or Bush or Clinton administrations. There's no bombers flying.
I think there's a difference here, however. You know, when you talk about Nixon, you're talking about the consummate insider.
Right.
When you talk about Trump, you're talking about the most outside president that we had in the 20th century.
That's
he
right.
does not come from either this enormous traditional wealth, let us say like the Roosevelt, nor does he come from a bureaucratic political insider position like, for example, Woodrow Wilson.
Right.
He is further outside of the political class than Jimmy Carter was. Jimmy Carter was perhaps the most outside president before Trump.
Right.
The other thing is, people who have been like Trump or Trump-like, in essence, and ran for president, lose. For example, Henry Wallace. Trump is closer to Henry Wallace than to any president since Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And as you know, Henry Wallace was the progressive, the left wing, the, who was supposed to be the vice president in Roosevelt's last term, but they gave it to the guy, the haberdasher to Truman. So, Dig, this is extraordinary times that we're living in. A consummate outsider wins and can win again on a platform that I'm an outsider and I am disrupting the political establishment.
And, you know, they prove it every day that they beat up on him and he survives because... You know, I pointed out to someone just today that when someone takes the kind of press that Trump's been taking since 2015, really, since he first started to utter the foreign policy heresies about NATO and regime change wars and all that, you know, people don't last more than 3 days, 4 days in public life with that stuff. Ask Howard Dean, for example.
Yeah.
He was on top of the world. He got bad press for less than a week, and he was gone. You know, Gary Hart, you know, all of this. They go on Johnny Carson, crack a couple jokes, Saturday Night Live does a skit, bye, sayonara, next. You know, and that's the case. We're coming up to about 30 seconds left. What do you see happening next in 30 seconds?
Well, I see the mainstream media and the Democratic Party and all of the candidates now having to respond to this bold and unexpected move by Trump. When you put Bolton's leaving or firing alongside of what anybody that has any sense can see, Trump's attempt to really end the war in Afghanistan, allowing a coalition government to come to power, or even a Taliban government. When you put all this together, this guy as the candidate of peace or imperial retreat, I think that's what he is. And I think along with a generally growing economy and his position on peace, I think he's unbeatable by the group of Democrats that he's facing.
Professor Montero, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.